What happened on Friday reminded many of us of another tragic school shooting, the one, of course, at Columbine High School on April 20th, 1999. That is the day Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold killed 12 students and one teacher, as well as injuring 24 others. This morning we talked to Dave Cullen, one of the first reporters on the scene that fateful day. Cullen is author of Columbine, which is really the definitive account of what happened on that day, and will share with us about why Americans suffer so many gun massacres and the lessons we should be taking, not just on gun control, but on mental health care. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Dave Cullen to the roundtable. Dave, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. It's always sad that I'm required in these situations.
It certainly is. And in our conversations yesterday in setting up this conversation, it struck me that the one of the messages that you said you wanted to get across, and one of the things that you've been working on over the past few days, is talking to victims of Columbine and teachers who were there that day, who must react in a completely different way than all of us when they hear of an event like this, and the messages really that they want to get out.
Yep. And of course, each one is different, and that's one of the most important things that I can express to people, especially in that community, that the survivors of previous communities want people to know, is that each person is so radically different in the way they approach grief and also the timing. And so, especially if you're in that community, if you have a friend or a neighbor or a loved one, and the person doesn't seem to be, quote, dealing with it, or, you know, they're not showing a lot of emotion, or they're showing way too much emotion, they can't stop sobbing, or whatever it is they're doing, that's okay, you know, short of dangerous things, obviously, but everybody has their own way, and they really want to be able to process it in their own way. And often outsiders really try to control that a little much and worry about them. And the survivors tend to come to resent that. Or when they inevitably have relapses and people start thinking, you know, why are you not over this yet? Or that's what they hear, actually. That's what the victims start to hear in the messages of, like, you know, heal, closure. The victims tend to hear, get on with it. And so we can be really much more understanding with them and just realizing and understanding ourselves that people are different. And so even if you have two close people who are reacting completely differently, that's okay. That's normal for them to be completely different, and give them the space to do that. And I might have gotten a little off track there.
No, not at all. You're very much on track, because I do wonder, because it seems like it's both a blessing and a curse. It would seem to me that a lot of the healing can begin once the news trucks leave and the spotlights go off, and we stop doing 24/7 news coverage from the backyard of where this tragedy took place. And yet, then when that glare goes away, we expect everything to be better all of a sudden, and it takes a long time, obviously.
It does, and I can give you some interesting data on that from Columbine, which surprised actually the counselors there and the people, but they hadn't been through something like that before. And it may be a slightly scary, actually, for your audience, but I mean, I think it's helpful to know the truth in advance and see it coming. So with the school at Columbine, of course, they brought in counselors, and they had a in-school counseling session that was free, drop-in. Anyone could come in at any time, whenever they needed, as often as they needed. And they tracked how many visits they got. And their assumption was, you know, the first few weeks after, there would be, you know, tremendous number. And then it would, you know, gradually go down and taper off at some point. Well, kind of the opposite happened. I mean, they had a lot right away, but instead of dropping, it continued to rise, and it continued to rise steadily for 6 months. It didn't hit the peak until 6 months. And a lot of people were first still just coming in at that point. And I asked one of the heads who ran the program a couple of years later, you know, why? What would cause a person to wait 6 months and then decide to do it? And she just shook her head and she said, often it's when everything else has failed and they've given up everything else. Because a lot of people, you know, have a stigma attached to counseling or don't think they need it or will help them or whatever. And at some point, a lot of people, you know, resist it, and realize at some point, okay, this isn't working. I can't do this myself. I'll go in. But what I want to say, too, is then the utilization peaked at about 6 months out, but then it stayed at that same level, you know, obviously with, you know, daily fluctuations, but roughly at that same level for another year and a half. So we're talking 2 years out. People were still at that same level of needing help, coming in to seek it for 2 years. And unfortunately, also, this is a little scary, but it's reality. They were really careful about, they created a suicide watch list for students. There's 2,000 students in the school. And, of course, that was private. But they had teachers, everybody on the lookout for who's in trouble, talking to them, talking to their parents, and paying special attention to these kids. And they kept a running list for kids to, you know, get extra help. And the number on that list stayed roughly constant for that same period, up to 2 years out. And they told me that, you know, some people would be on the list just for a few weeks or a few months. They'd get past it, they'd work through it, and they would come off. But just regular, just as some, you know, one or two kids would roll off, another one or two would roll on. So there were some people whose the depth of their symptoms, obviously they were having grief, reaching that level also often can be delayed up to a year or two or longer out there. So again, it's all part of this process. Some people keep it bottled up inside and really aren't dealing with the feelings for quite a period of time, and then it all comes rushing out at one point. It can be overnight or it can be more gradual. Again, everybody's different that way too. But, you know, I can tell you that so many of the families told me later that they wished they had gone to counseling sooner and or stayed with it longer and not just felt like, oh, I'm okay now. You know, Frank DeAngelis, the principal at Columbine, who's still there, who I've talked to many times, and he's having a rough week, but, you know, he told me if there was one thing he would do differently, it would have been, you know, get into counseling that first day and go with his entire family because they didn't all understand what he was going through. He actually ended up getting a divorce about a year or two after Columbine, which wasn't necessarily completely related. They had some problems with their marriage before, but he's not sure. I mean, he thinks it definitely played a factor. But his wife, his parents, he had, I believe, just the one son, and, you know, other people very close to him didn't understand exactly what he was going through or how to respond to him in a positive way and what was good or bad for him. And he said if he could do it over, he would, you know, get all the people with him too, because, you know, when you leave the counseling session, you're still back out on your own, but you're not doing this alone. You're with the community.
Dave Cullen is our guest in this half hour. He is the author of the book Columbine, and we are going to return in just a moment and talk about some of the lessons of Columbine, including the need to address adolescent depression. Dave Cullen will be with us. We'll return after the short break. Dave Cullen is our guest this morning. He is the author of the book Columbine. And before the break, as I mentioned, Dave, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program is because as I was thinking of this, I actually referred to your book Columbine, and because you were really one of the only people I felt that was talking about some of the issues, because we talk a lot about the culture, and a lot of times that gets wrapped up into guns. And you talk a lot in the book about mental health. You talk a lot in the book about depression, of these two students at Columbine, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. And one of the things that is fascinating to me and that I think many people don't understand and that you make such a brilliant point in the book highlighting is that we don't often equate depression with violence.
Right.
And yet this is such a huge part of what we're seeing in the adolescents who commit these horrific acts.
Exactly. It's quite counterintuitive. I was, surprised, and I would also say skeptical, when I first was investigating this, was told by the people, the experts on the case, Eric was a sadistic psychopath. Once I came to fully understand what that was and studied it, that made complete sense. But, that Dylan was an extreme depressive, and I was sort of like, huh. And kind of like, I'm not sure I buy that. I definitely don't understand it. But I think that's normal. We think of depression as extremely sad, and it's something much more than that, which is, we should probably talk about, but we can come back to that. But it's this depth, and, I picture somebody with their, sort of slinking along, their head down, and in extreme depressive cases, speaking softly, not very often, staying a lot of quiet frequently, just, a really down person. And it's sort of like the opposite image I have in my mind of a killer as being someone very outward and aggressive. Obviously, they're doing an aggressive act when they when they shoot, and the pictures just don't really fit. And the thing is with depression is that the shorthand that psychologists referred to depression as anger turned inward. And so if you think about a depressed person, a severely depressed person, every day they wake up in the morning and somebody tells them they're a piece of crap. And like, you idiot. Oh, and now you're going to go to school or work or whatever today. Everybody hates you because you're such a loser. And you're going to do it again just like yesterday. You said the wrong thing to, blah, blah, blah. And all day long, they get heckled and just derided by the person who matters most to them. And that person is themselves. And so all day long, they're angry at themselves and they're taking it out of themselves. And so we don't see all that when we see the depressive person because we're not hearing the voice in their head that they're hearing. And I don't mean this in, mental illness terms,
right,
voice in their head. I mean, a normal, normal conversation we all have in our head about ourselves. But we don't see that. So, of course, anybody who's just beaten up and, psychologically every day is going to be mopey and morose and dejected. And so we're seeing those external signs, but we're oblivious to the angry part inside that's at the cause of all that. So depression isn't really outwardly what it looks like, what's going on inside that human being. So that's the starting point. Now, these depressives, first of all, we need to get rid of the stigma around depression and make it really clear that 99.9% of severely depressed people are not going to hurt anybody else. If they're, statistically, they're not more likely to be any dangerous to you. And in fact, the main danger is to themselves, either worst case suicide, but, often drug and alcohol addiction, having unsafe sex, leading to teen pregnancies, dropping out of high school, those sorts of messing up their own life. But in a very, very tiny fraction of the cases, they will take the extreme step when they get to a helpless and hopeless state of killing themselves. And a tiny fraction of those who are will also externalize their anger and feel like, okay, this isn't just my fault. I didn't do this. Those other people did this to me. And will take it out usually on the one person they see central to that problem. So if they're having problem with a girlfriend or a wife or what have you like that, they'll kill the girlfriend. If it's a problem at home, kill the parents. If it's at work, kill the boss, and so forth. So it's the person who's sort of the symbol and the central person of the problem area. That's the most common way someone will externalize this and kill someone else and then themselves, these deeply depressed people.
I just want to interrupt for a moment because you write in the book, and I went back and reread the book over the weekend, and one of the things that I found so interesting was when Dylan and Eric were arrested, and this was well before the murders at the school, they were a part of a juvenile diversion program.
Right.
And the parents took part. And you write in the book about Eric's parents taking part. And there's this mental health section. They have a checklist of 30 problem areas. And the parents marked anger and depression and suicidal thoughts. And the thing that struck me is Eric, when he filled out that, marked 14. Everything related to distrust, everything related to aggression, jealousy, anxiety, suspiciousness, authority figures, temper, racing thoughts, obsessive thoughts, mood swings, disorganized thoughts. He did skip suicidal thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And checked homicidal thoughts.
Absolutely. And he did check homicidal thoughts. So what do we take from that? I mean, to me, that makes your point. So what do we then do as a culture and as a society and as a school district and as parents to address these huge warning bells that are going off enough so that this kid shared it on a form?
Right. Yeah, the warning signs is really important, but it's a little tricky because usually nearly all the cases people are giving off just warning signs like crazy, the people involved in these kinds of things, and depressives who aren't going to kill are too, but they're giving off warning signs of problem, but not of a violent problem or mass murder. So there's no way to see, if you look at most of these cases, any counselor will say, or any teacher will tell you, well, that sounds like a quarter of the teenage boys in my class or anything,
right.
Morose, that's sort of adolescence. Although these are, more extreme cases, but still, nothing screams out as mass murder. So the more I've studied this and the more, the FBI did an amazing exhaustive study about this and sort of the Secret Service, and then I've, spent a lot of time with the authors of those reports and the people brought in to do them. And it's pretty clear that it's rare that we will be able to sort of spot these warning signs in advance of murders, except in the case where they tell someone they're going to do it, which turns out to be most of the cases. So that's great, and that has stopped a huge number of these plots, essentially kids bragging in advance, and believe
right.
it or not, more than 80% of them do. But putting that part aside, we can't, if our mindset and our goal or our approach is, okay, we will identify these mass murders before it happens and get them help, get the mass murderers help, identify them and get them help, that's never going to work because we're never going to identify them all. What we can do is identify the much, much larger pool of literally a few million kids who are clinically deeply depressed, get all of them help, and we will, it'll pay for itself so many times over, just, to the economy, so it's an easy no-brainer, financially.
And not just in regards to school shootings or into mass violence, but just so these people can live their lives in a more loving and joyful way.
Yes, and right, and productive. And the only reason I brought money into it is because as soon as you start talking about things
right.
like this, some
people
get their dander up, like, oh,
absolutely.
Another government program. But this is one that's like, this is a no-brainer. The productivity society for the next 50 years will so outweigh what you will spend. But anyway, so the bigger point was, you take these few million kids who are clinically depressed, you get help to those kids, you're not going to successfully treat all of them. But you may have it. We have a high success rate with depression. If we, I don't want to say cure, but significantly help, say 75% or 80% of them, we will improve the lives drastically of, those 80% of people. In the process, we will neutralize a great number of our mass murders, our potential mass murders, who we never knew were there. And in the process, we'll never find out that this was a guy who was headed toward a road of mass murder. He will just quietly get better and not continue down that road. But over time, and not much time, with very short order, we'll start to see the number of these mass murders drop. I think that is the one clear lesson we should have learned and one clear way we can really address and lower the number of these mass shootings and in the process save so many other kids as well.
So there are undoubtedly many lessons. There were many lessons to be learned from Columbine, and no doubt as you worked on this book for 10 years. So
yes, start to finish, yeah.
Over 10 years, I assume we're going to learn a lot more about the lessons that we'll learn from this horrific event as well.
I think we really will, and some of it really takes time. Hopefully not as long as in Columbine, because there were problems with certain members of the Sheriff's Department covering things up and withholding evidence. So it actually took 7 years and a court battle to the Colorado State Supreme Court to get the most important evidence, the killer's journals, released. You know, and that's kind of not unnecessary and unusual. So I don't think it will be years, but it is often, it could be 6 months or a year or two before, you know, we get most. It was quite a while for a complete report from Virginia Tech. They like to be very, very thorough, and they spent nearly a year on Columbine just investigating it. So, yes, so it will take time, and we have to be really careful in the meantime, as both members of the media and the public, of jumping to too many conclusions, because I think the authorities do, I totally understand why, for the short run, over these weeks and months, do have to keep a lot of that information close to the vest, because there are so many important investigative techniques where they don't want to, they don't want to influence different witnesses by letting them hear what they've learned from others. They want to get fresh, unadulterated take from every witness, whether it was a person who was present or someone who knew the killer any time in their life. So it's very, very important for them to not release all that information early on in order to get to the truth. But then at some point, once they've gathered all that, then normally they will be forthcoming and will understand a lot longer. But there will be some big surprises that we in the I would bet law enforcement people already understand, but can't share with us. And I'll tell you, after Columbine, I spent a lot of time with the head of the FBI unit in the investigation, who had a dozen special agents working for him, and he said he would come home that first week. You know, they'd be putting in 12, 14, 16-hour days, and he'd come home and then, you know, turn on the TV and you know, or pick up the newspaper and watch the coverage. And he said it was like two different cases. It was like at the office or the crime scene was like an completely different case than this sort of fictional case he was reading about and hearing about in the media. That's how wrong we had it, but
Dave,
they couldn't correct it at that time.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I appreciate your time. Dave Cullen is the author of the book Columbine. You can read more by going to davecullen.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.